Hello, I'm Howie Silbiger. This is number 0491, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0491. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Ellen Corman Maines, who is the author of Buried Rivers, A Spiritual Journey into the Holocaust. What's worse, those who forget about the Holocaust or those who simply deny it?
Both are pretty bad. It's unfortunate that we would not teach the lessons of the Holocaust and keep that alive. But I have to say, denying it is sort of like spreading a poison. It's actually trying to reignite anti-Semitism. It only happens as a pretense for continuing some kind of racial agenda, some kind of anti-Semitism, very far-right agenda that doesn't do humanity any good at all. And it is spreading a poison.
Diane Otten, author of The Joys of Raising Boys, talks about some of the myths women have about men, such as the best time to communicate.
As a female, and I'm trying to communicate with my husband, who's pretty masculine in the way that he communicates. And part of it for me is to just recognize, first of all, time and place. So I think as women, sometimes we corner our men to talk to us in times and places that are maybe not the most comfortable for them to open up. So to think about, well, when can I have this conversation? Sometimes when you are dying to have the conversation, you just have to take a step back. I do this all the time and go, is this the right time and place? And if it's not, I wait until it is the right time and place. And then the results are just so much better.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. And Book Banter looks back at the Montreal Expo's biggest day of infamy in Danny Gallagher's book Blue Monday. Let's go back to October of 1981 with Nos Amours later this inning on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0491 was Howie Silbiger, who is a radio host and the founder of True Talk Radio. And by the way, True Talk Radio is one of the many places you can also find the Stuff File program. You can find out more information about True Talk Radio by going to their website at truetalkradio.com. And of course, you'll find the link by going to thestufffile.com. All you have to do is simply check the program number that Howie just mentioned. You see how that all comes around full circle? And you'll find the link. Thank you very much, Howie, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? On January 7th, a Salinas, California family's Ring doorbell camera captured video of a man licking the doorbell for more than 3 hours. The homeowners were out of town during the encounter, which took place at around 5 a.m., but their children were inside. Sylvia Dungan, who was alerted to the activity at her front door on her phone, said, "I thought, boy, there's a lot of traffic. Who the heck is that?" Salinas police identified the man as 33-year-old Roberto Daniel Arroyo. Arroyo also relieved himself in the front yard and visited a neighbor's house. You kind of laugh about it afterwards because technically he didn't do anything, Dungan said, although police later charged him with petty theft and prowling. You know, it's a good thing this story took place in Salinas, California, because if it took place here in Montreal, where it's currently around minus 15 degrees Celsius, I doubt he would be able to lick a Ring doorbell for 3 hours. At least, not voluntarily, anyway. And you know, it's a weird story when you mention someone relieving himself in a front yard, and that's the part of the story that draws absolutely no attention. Yeah. 49-year-old Dave Sauerbeck of Pittston, Pennsylvania, had football on his mind after his arresting start to 2019. In the early morning hours of January 3rd, he used a hammer to break into the Rock Street Music Store and helped himself to two guitars to start with. Presumably realizing he was being watched by surveillance cameras, Sauerbeck left and returned to the store wearing a mask and grabbed three more guitars. Police tracked Sauerbeck down using the surveillance camera shot of his license plate and found the stolen guitars in his home. Upon his arrest, the only statement he made was, "Go Eagles!" Yep, Eagles fans. The same tribe who famously booed Santa Claus one year. That's one interesting gene pool. A gene pool that doesn't seem to have a deep end. Case in point, and speaking of Philly, Eakins Oval, a Philadelphia traffic circle, was the scene of an ominous accident on January 1st when a 21-year-old unnamed man tried to climb a monument to George Washington at the center of the circle. The man slipped while climbing and fell on the sharp antler of a large deer statue at the base of the monument, impaling his left side. He suffered lacerations and was admitted to Henneman Hospital, which is nearby. Well, that's a case of here stops the buck. Veterinarian Molly Cruz of Springfield, Virginia, is planning to purchase an artificial Christmas tree next time after her natural one came with something extra, more than 100 praying mantises. Cruz said the leggy insects emerged from a sack under the tree's branches and were crawling on the walls, crawling on the ceilings, crawling on the windows. Kraus captured as many as she could and was hoping to find a new home for them, as it seems, quote, "people really like the bugs." Really? The Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture advised that people who find the egg sacs on their Christmas tree should clip the branch and take it outside. Otherwise, without their regular source of food, the newly hatched insects will start to eat each other. Well, I don't really see a downside to that, but that's just me. I mean, that could be kind of fun to watch. It's a good thing that Molly is a cool, calm, and collected veterinarian, because I know many people, and I'm not saying just women, who would completely flip out with over 100 praying mantises crawling on the walls, ceiling, and windows of their home. And we have time for one more story here on this section of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, before we get to our first guest on the show. It seems to be it's time for the Darwin File.
I am the Grim Reaper. I am death.
A Sri Lankan man apparently read too many Tarzan books when he was a kid because he tried to hypnotize a wild elephant. He wasn't successful. Video footage shows the unnamed man walking up to a wild male elephant grazing in a forest clearing. He then gestures to get the huge animal's attention, after which it begins charging at him. In what is said to have been an attempt to hypnotize the elephant and stop it in its tracks, the man does not run away. The elephant knocks the man to the ground and tramples him to death on the spot. Human interaction with wild elephants is not uncommon in the area, as expansion of infrastructure and homes has destroyed the animal's natural habitat. Now, as you know, elephants never forget, so I pity the fool who tries to hypnotize this elephant again in the future, because, as all of you know, and the elephant now knows, in the Darwin File, the Tree of Life is often self-pruning.
I have come for you.
Yes. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? This year, second-generation Holocaust survivor and best-selling memoirist Ellen Corman Maines will mark International Holocaust Remembrance Day on January 27th at the site of the infamous Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland. She's making the trip, one of many she has taken, to ensure that the world does not forget the murder of over 6 million Jews who were killed in concentration camps and mass graves during World War II. Ellen is the author of Buried Rivers, A Spiritual Journey into the Holocaust. She joins us via Skype from Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Ellen.
Hi. Glad to be with you.
Thanks very much for being on the program with us. as someone who is a second generation Holocaust survivor, the memories, the story of the Holocaust is never far from your memory, is it?
That's right. That's right. I was thinking, you know, it's funny to say I'm going there for International Holocaust Remembrance Day because that never leaves my awareness. But I still think it's very powerful to participate in something with others.
Those who survive the Holocaust are just by years advanced age are dying off. They're not, they won't be around too much longer to share their stories. Besides that, there are people out there who, as you know, are out and out deniers of the Holocaust. What is worse in your estimation, not remembering or simply denying?
Well, you know, both are pretty bad. I mean, it's unfortunate that we would not teach the lessons of the Holocaust and keep that alive. But I have to say, denying it is sort of like spreading a poison. It's actually trying to reignite anti-Semitism and maybe put it under the guise of, you know, these days you can pretend to be legitimate, you can pretend to be doing some kind of, you know, academic, you know, have some kind of legitimate something or other on the internet. But really, it only happens as a pretense for continuing some kind of racial agenda, some kind of anti-Semitism, very far right agenda that doesn't do humanity any good at all. And it is spreading a poison.
It's very important for the Jewish community to remember what has taken place, but how important is it for the rest of the world, for those who are not Jews, to be fully aware of what took place in the Holocaust and to keep it at least partially in their minds at all times?
Yeah, because genocides have continued to happen and are continuing to happen. And also because wherever people go after Jews, they also go after other people, people of color, gypsies, LGBT, anyone who doesn't fit a certain narrow agenda, who's regarded as another. So you could say Jews are, you know, anti-Semitism is one of many prejudices. And so I don't think humanity's in good shape when that's going on.
And the thing is, when people think of genocides, they think of places that are, let's be honest, mostly third world countries, mostly impoverished countries. But that wasn't Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It was a
yes.
major metropolitan city and country that these atrocities took place in. And people sometimes take it for granted that, oh, well, you know, what happens in Rwanda, what happens in the Middle East, that can't happen here. But Germany was a thriving community. And part of the modern European world, correct?
That's right. And also the Jews were the most integrated and part of that society, part of, you know, privileged society there as much as anywhere else in the world.
Now, you've written the book, Buried Rivers. Who did you write the book for?
Good question. I think I wrote it, you know, partly for myself, partly to honor my family history. But really, I wrote it because once I started traveling to Poland, I experienced such a powerful sense of connection and blessing from reconnecting with the place of my ancestors and feeling them supporting me, that I just thought it was an extraordinary experience. And the book was motivated because I had an experience on a train in 2005 where I felt the energy of the Holocaust, the energy of the dead, kind of asking me to help them. And the question seemed to be, how can you still believe in basic goodness? So that's what motivated me to go to Poland. And then once I started going, I just started to really experience such a powerful sense of reconnection that it was sort of like making my own life whole again. And I felt that this ancestral connection was something that needed to be shared with others, as well as commemorating the whole history.
Well, you kind of answered the question, but you are going back to Poland for International Holocaust Remembrance Day. You have made the trip on more than one occasion. What makes you want to keep going back?
I go back there because at this point I have very strong relationships with Polish people, and I simply I just feel like it's an ongoing project. It's not a one-time project. So I feel like there's something being healed just by my being there, reconnecting with people who also want to come together. And a lot of Polish people do. So there's also a stereotype among Jews that, you know, Poles are anti-Semites. They don't like the Jews. But actually, that's really a huge stereotype. I'm not saying there wasn't anti-Semitism. But actually, there was also many hundreds of years when they lived in relative peace together and where Jews had more freedom than anywhere else. So to me, Poland is a very important place for intercultural communication and for the Jews, amongst other people.
You mentioned earlier the kind of mindset that leads to what was the Holocaust. With such tragedy happening within your own family and seeing some of these atrocities, as you mentioned, take place still in many places around the world, how do you regain your faith in humanity?
Yeah, well, that is a $64,000 question. And that's not something that I can give like a two-word answer to, because it's more like you have to dig down deep and you have to trust that underneath the aggression and the fear that makes people do things like kill other people, you know, they do that out of their own misunderstanding, their own fear and lack of education. But they are not fundamentally bad people. So I don't believe in demonizing people. I believe in educating and in learning about the inner causes that contribute to us causing harm instead of going along with our nature, which actually fundamentally, I think, is more good than bad. But, you know, it's a tough sell after the Holocaust, so you do have to dig down deep.
Collectively, as someone who is a second-generation Holocaust survivor, are you always looking over your shoulder? I mean, you know, last year was the 80th anniversary of Kristallnacht. Do you see anything in current situations, either in Europe or even in North America, that reminds you of the genesis of what that situation was over 80 years ago?
Well, it's definitely, yeah, the shooting in Pittsburgh, that created a much bigger reverberation in myself and everyone I knew, Jewish and non-Jewish. And just all of the, especially living in the U.S., the degree of shooting, the number of shootings and violence. Personally, I don't really live looking over my shoulder too much. I just don't have that kind of personality or, you know, I have my nervousness about the world. But no, I'm not too personally nervous, but I am very concerned.
I mentioned earlier who you wrote the book for. When you speak to readers, when you get involved, if you do book signings or public speaking or anything like that, are you cognizant of the fact that there may be members of your audience who are non-Jews? Are you trying to reach the non-Jewish community and share your story? Because I think it's a story that's important to the world, not just to Jews.
Yes, I agree. And I feel like I have a kind of 50-50 audience. I spent a lot of years basically being trained as a Buddhist. That's more my orientation in terms of a spiritual path. And so I have friends of all religions, and I feel as welcomed and as relevant to people, you know, who are non-Jews as well as Jews.
And when you talk to non-Jews, do they take to the story? Do they take to the history of the Holocaust as something that is important to remember? In other words, you never come across people who say, you know, the Holocaust, that was two generations ago almost. Let's move on. You don't get that sentiment, do you?
I do not. I mean, I did get that. I think I mentioned to you before the show, I did have a Holocaust denier make that kind of a comment to me on my website. And this was a far-right activist who I found. But no one else has ever said anything like that to me. I always find a tremendous amount of compassion. And I've been surprised by that. But I've been surprised about how many people in the world that I speak to actually immediately have a strong connection and resonance with what the message is.
You are going, as I mentioned, to Poland for International Holocaust Remembrance Day. I don't know if you've been there in previous trips at any kind of particular commemoration, but does it mean something more to you to go back at this time than in other times you've gone?
A little bit, yes. I've been aware, I'm very aware of the anniversary date because when I had that experience on the train, unbeknownst to me, it was the week of the 27th of January back in 2005, and it was the 60th anniversary. So there were a lot of commemorations happening in Europe, and I was completely unaware of it. So personally, it marks the beginning of my journey with this book and this journey. But also, I have been there I've been at other commemorations. So I'm very connected to the city of Lodz in the center of Poland, where my mother was from. And I do regularly go to commemorations there of the liquidation of the ghetto, which was the second largest ghetto in Europe. And I'll be there this summer for the 75th anniversary of that, which is very important to me personally. So I haven't been to one of these in January at Auschwitz. I've been to other events, but not quite of this. I don't really know what to expect. I expect it to be larger.
You mentioned being on a train. When you're there, are you cognizant of the fact of the history those tracks have than just being a train that you're on at the moment?
Yes. Well, you mean any train?
Yeah.
Or a train in Poland. Yeah, well, I felt it when I was on the train in Germany. Even though it was a very modern train, there was just, you know, my mind just could not escape the metaphor, you know, of being on a train in Germany and looking out the window and seeing chain link fences, and somehow the Holocaust was very strongly evoked. I have to say I travel a lot on trains in Poland, and I don't have the same feeling actually there, but I'm well aware of the train tracks, and of course when you go into Birkenau, you know, that's how you come in. You follow the train tracks.
The book is called Buried Rivers: A Spiritual Journey into the Holocaust. Ellen, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you so much.
Ellen Korman-Maines, author of Buried Rivers, A Spiritual Journey into the Holocaust. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the page for this show, which is show number 0491, and you'll find links to Ellen's website and also links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. The best thing since sliced bread. No loafing here.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about some of the myths that women have about men. Plus, Stuart Nolman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on. Plus, much more Stuff File news right here, right now, on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to this program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Now, back to the stuff. You know, we come across a lot of weird stories that hail from the state of Florida. I don't want to make it appear that we're picking on the Sunshine State, but you gotta wonder just what's in the water down there. Case in point, 42-year-old Heather Carpenter was charged with damaging property and criminal mischief in Sarasota County, Florida, after expressing in a particularly gross way her dissatisfaction with the principal of the school where Carpenter was substitute teaching. Philippi Shores Elementary School principal Allison Foster had been helping Carpenter with a professional issue, but Carpenter was unhappy with the way it was going. So, on December the 1st, in a park where Foster was hosting a birthday party for her daughter later in the day, Carpenter, whose own daughter was invited to the party, arrived with human feces, according to a witness, which she spread on the grill and picnic tables. Carpenter pleaded not guilty, but the sheriff's office report stated that she admitted she intentionally placed human waste and fecal matter on the tables at Erfer Park with the intent of disrupting the birthday party planned by Foster. Now, was it her own feces or someone else's? Actually, does it really matter? How does someone's mind work that way? And why are they teaching children? And still with teachers, students at a Fairfield, Ohio middle school were subjected to an unexpected lesson on January 8th when they reported suspicious behavior taking place behind the desk of substitute teacher Tracy J. Abraham of Cincinnati. The school resource officer at Creekside Middle School received several complaints from students that the teacher was, taking matters into his own hands, and he was removed from the room and building. Abraham was booked and charged with public indecency and ordered to stay away from all locations where there are children under 18 years old. So, I guess that means he can't go to the movies or the mall either. Just what kind of creepy lesson plan does this guy have anyway? Yikes. Anyway, moving along, a hotel guest wearing a Casper the Ghost-style bedsheet with eye holes cut out stole money from the hotel's cash register. 59-year-old Joseph Elder carried out the robbery at the Ramada Inn in Wayne, New Jersey, around 11:30 p.m. on December 29th. Elder leaped over a counter in the hotel's lobby and stole a wad of cash. He got into the lobby of the Ramada Inn through a now-shuttered adjacent restaurant while wearing the sheet. After Elder entered the lobby, he allegedly jumped over the hotel desk counter, pried open a cash register, and stole an unspecified amount of money before fleeing through the restaurant. Officers searching the area after the robbery learned that Elder was actually staying in a room in the hotel. He was arrested and charged with burglary and theft. You know, his makeshift Casper outfit is just one step removed from looking like he was a member of the Klan. I haven't been able to find out exactly how they knew it was him. A part of me is kind of hoping that they found him in bed under the sheet with two of his toes sticking through the eye holes. A female jogger on the Goldenrod Trail in Oakland, California, used pepper spray on a dog that attacked her on the morning of January 3rd, angering the dog's owner, 19-year-old Alma Cadwallader. Police say Alma retaliated by tackling and punching the jogger multiple times and finally biting the victim on the forearm, causing significant wounds. Police posted a surveillance camera photograph of Alma and asked for the public's help in identifying her. She was arrested on January 4th. Well, that's irony for you, pepper spraying a dog because you're afraid of being bitten, only to suffer bites from the dog's owner. Perhaps Alma is the one who needs a muzzle. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 26-year-old Rogelio Tapia was arrested in Des Moines, Iowa on December 31st after a dispute at a Quick Trip around 3 a.m. The store clerk and witnesses told police Tapia chased the clerk around the store and assaulted him with a banana after the clerk tried to intervene in a domestic situation. Tapia caused about $1,000 in damage. He was charged with assault and third-degree criminal mischief. You know, Bananas don't hurt people. People with bananas hurt people. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Diane Otten is back on the program with us. She's an interpersonal communication expert and the author of The Joys of Raising Boys, The Good, the Bad, and the Hilarious. She says women have some misguided ideas about men. For example, it's not true that men aren't emotional beings, or that just because they aren't looking at you doesn't mean they are not listening to you. Diane joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you back on the program. We spoke about your book the last time and some of the funny things little boys say, and as you found out, just raising a couple yourself. This is also an interesting topic, too, and the reason why it caught my eye when I saw the little blurb about it is the second part of the example that I gave in the headlines, and that is, or the introduction, the idea that just because they aren't looking at you doesn't mean they're not listening to you. I bring that one up because I remember a study that I had seen several years ago, probably in the late 70s, early 80s, where they put two little boys in a room together and two little girls in a room together, and two chairs were in the room, but they were not side by side. They were just two chairs separated from each other, and they were told to take the chairs and sit down and talk.
Mm-hmm.
And the two little girls took the two chairs and put them so they were almost touching knees. They were looking at each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the two boys put the chairs against the wall side by side.
Yes.
And to me, that said everything.
That doesn't surprise me one bit. In fact, most of the research supports that very idea, that little boys from the time they're small and they're playing whatever games they're playing, most boy games happen side by side. So whether it's Legos, I have a pack of boys at my house right now that are between the ages of 13 and 15. It's a random rainy day in California. It doesn't happen very often, so they're all inside. And they're all sitting side by side. They've been playing video games, doing board games. But when you look at little girls, they're socialized, if you look at the games they play, to look at each other. Most of their games, whether it's dolls, mommy, baby, school, there's a lot of intensive eye contact. And so for that study you're referencing, that makes total sense. Most little girls are very comfortable sitting knee to knee, having that direct, intense eye contact, where most boys, because they haven't been socialized that way, are not very comfortable doing that. So it doesn't surprise me that those boys pulled those seats side by side. Very common.
And taking that one step further, I know from my own personal experience, just being a guy, having great emotional conversations with either women or men, for mm-hmm. me, they've taken place while I've been driving.
Yes, there's a definite magic to a car ride. And I would throw in there, Peter, too, especially with, I have teenage boys, so my boys are now 13 and 15, and they're budding adult, you know, men as well. We have the best conversations, not only in the car, but in the dark. So if you can get them in the car at night, that's another great way to have those really wonderful conversations with the men in your life, whether they're young men or adult men. Most men, when they don't feel like they have to have eye contact, will open up so much more. And that's with my boys, where I really have those beautiful, just very revealing conversations about what's going on in their life, how they feel. They're very hesitant to have those same exact conversations. Like, I took my son to dinner the other night, and we were sitting facing each other, and I was trying to have that kind of a conversation, but he just was not having any part of it because he was having to look at me. And so it didn't mean he wasn't listening to me, that he wasn't interested in talking to me about those things. However, later that night, I was sitting in, my boys share a bedroom, and we were sitting in the bedroom. They were in bed and I was sitting in a chair and the lights were out and we were talking. And then that's when the floodgates opened, when they didn't feel like they had to have that eye contact. And so for most women, we correlate this idea of people looking at you and eye contact with listening. And it doesn't mean that if a man's not looking at you, that he's necessarily listening or not. It could go either way. But what women do when they make the mistake of thinking that just as a man is not looking at them, that that man is not listening. And that could not be farther from the truth.
Okay, so how do we change that perception that women have of men? And I mean, here we are talking to someone, you are a professional, you're an interpersonal communications expert and the author of a book that talks about things like this.
Yes.
And yet you just said you tried to get into a conversation with your son at dinner and he wasn't, he wasn't having it. So
yeah.
How do you get past trying to do what apparently genetically guys aren't capable of doing?
Well, and let me throw in a caveat there too. Most of the research points at that it's a combination of both nature and nurture. So it's not that boys or men aren't able to do that. It's that they've been socialized to not have that eye contact. So my boys, I've socialized them from early age to have those conversations. So even though it's still not comfortable and they don't talk to their friends with that directed eye contact, we do get to have some of those good conversations still face to face. So I don't want your listeners to get the impression that men don't have the ability to sit and look at you and have a conversation. However, I would say, so back to your question, as a female, and I'm trying to communicate with my husband, for example, who's pretty masculine in the way that he communicates. And part of it for me is to just recognize, first of all, time and place. So when I was asking my son questions at dinner, we're under this super bright light, he's kind of distracted with other things. That was an error on my part because the timing was off. So think about time and place. And I go back to you're talking about the car. Like, that's a great time and place to bring up those conversations. So I think as women, sometimes we corner our men to talk to us in times and places that are maybe not the most comfortable for them to open up. So to think about, well, when can I have this conversation? Sometimes when you are dying to have the conversation, you just have to take a step back. I do this all the time and go, is this the right time and place? And if it's not, I wait until it is the right time and place. And then the results are just so much better.
Now, do you think the idea, as I said in the introduction, that women have some misguided ideas about men, is this the female equivalent of a guy who, when they're talking to a woman and asking her what's bothering her, that he just can't stop at listening as opposed to wanting to fix the problem?
Mm-hmm. So that's that knight in shining armor syndrome that a lot of men have, is that, and they're doing the fixing or trying to do the fixing with good intentions. That's what I think as women we need to understand. You know, men have good intentions when they're trying to help us solve a problem. And the male culture, which is very much a culture, and women have kind of their own culture too, is about fixing things. It's very goal-oriented, very linear, straightforward, to the point. And so when I come home from work, for example, and let's say I tell my husband, oh my gosh, I hate my job. I have all these extra responsibilities and I'm not getting paid for any of them and I'm going on and on. A typical male response would be, what do you think, Peter? If I'm going on and on and on about how much I hate my job.
Well, either quit your job or get another job or...
Yes. Exactly. So that's the typical male response is, well, why don't you quit? And as a woman, I don't want to quit my job. I just want to talk about the fact that I am unhappy at my job. And so as a woman, I just want him to listen to me. But as a man, men get so frustrated with women because they're like, they complain and complain. I tell them what to do. They don't do it. And then they just keep complaining. But I think if men were to step back and recognize, okay, she just needs to vent. And my husband, I have him really trained, for lack of a better word. So when I start doing stuff like that, he will say, do you want me to listen to you or do you want me to give you advice? And sometimes I say, I just want you to listen. And he says, okay. So he'll just sit and listen and have those really good, you know, great responses are things like, that sounds like it's really hard. Wow, how did you handle that? You know, things like that, rather than trying to give me solutions, because I don't want to quit my job. I love my job. I'm just having a bad day. And so I think both men and women can learn from each other in those situations. We all have good intentions. Those men are trying to help. And as women, we have to understand that too and not get frustrated when they do try to solve our problems.
Is part of the problem on the men's side in dealing with what we just described, the fact that women do want to vent and just get it out, not necessarily get answers, but men don't vent.
Right. And men, again, I go back to being socialized. A lot of times men have been socialized to withhold, especially feelings of vulnerability or emotions of vulnerability. And by that, I mean things like things aren't going well at their job, or if they're talking to their friends, for example, maybe they're having troubles in their intimate relationship. But that is an emotion of vulnerability to be able to express that to their friends and really explain and dive into their feelings about that. And so men oftentimes really shut down when it comes to those emotions of vulnerability. They don't want to talk about, doesn't mean they don't want to, they just honestly probably aren't comfortable with it or really know how to express those emotions, because we've told our little boys since they were little to hide their emotion, to, you know, grow a pair or suck it up or all those other things we tell our boys.
Or worse yet,
we don't want them.
Or worse yet, man up.
Man up, all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, think about those things we tell our boys, and then they grow up and they've learned all along to hide their emotions and their feelings of vulnerability, and they become adult men. And then as adult women, we want to get into a relationship with these adult men. And then all of a sudden we're angry because they're not emoting and they're not sharing, but they've been taught all along not to do that. And so I think as women, we have to be patient with the men in our life. And it doesn't mean that we can't get them to start opening up. It doesn't mean they don't want to open up. They just really have never practiced that. They don't know how. And so as partners to these adult men, I think women sometimes get angry. And I know with my husband, sometimes I get frustrated if he doesn't want to express himself, although he's pretty expressive. But I have to be patient with him. And if I can get him in the car, I go back to all those other things we just talked about. It really helps him to open up and to talk to me.
Diane, it's always a pleasure to have you on the program. It's always enlightening. I thank you very much for being on the show with us once again.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate your time.
Diane Otten, author of The Joys of Raising Boys, The Good, The Bad, and The Hilarious. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0491, and you'll find links to Diane's page, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Wouldn't it be nice if there was a simple way to get rid of all the frivolous lawsuits we hear about in the news? For example, when a blind man is walking through a mall with the help of his seeing-eye dog and accidentally steps on a woman's foot and then is sued by that woman, and yes, that's a real lawsuit, shouldn't there be an easy way for a judge to throw that case out? Believe it or not, there is a way. The lawyer representing a victim of a frivolous lawsuit simply has to ask the judge to dismiss it. Whether the judge does that is another matter, but the point is, judges must be asked first. Let's be fair, you'd think every lawyer who's hired to defend someone from a frivolous lawsuit would do that, but not so. Several judges have told me over the years that too many lawyers simply don't ask them to dismiss frivolous lawsuits. Now, I don't want to step on anyone's toes here, but if someone ever files a frivolous case against you, make sure your lawyer's first move is to have that case dismissed. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And up at the plate right now is Stuart Nauman. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And it's not a serving plate or the Queen's plate. You know, we're talking about baseball. Yes, we can talk about baseball all year long if we like.
There's even a television network that offers up stuff on baseball all year round. So.
Yeah, so you know, why should it end at the World Series? So,
exactly. And plus, we're not that far from when pitchers have to report for spring training. It's mere weeks away.
I know. It can't come any sooner, I'll tell you that. But on this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at baseball, Montreal Expos, and a certain day in Expos history. You know, because this year, Peter, marks the 50th anniversary of the Montreal Expos inaugural season, which made them the very first Major League Baseball franchise to originate from outside the U.S. And during its 36 seasons, the Expos nurtured a number of excellent players that have ever donned its red, white, and blue uniform before they went to greener pastures and salaries with other Major League Baseball teams. And it experienced a number of memorable moments and seasons, and in turn had undergone its share of days of infamy. And, you know, you could count them, you could rattle them off very easily, but there's one day of infamy that will still resonate and still does deeply with Expos players and fans alike. Was October 19th, 1981. That was when, during Game 5 of the National League Championship Series at the cavernous Olympic Stadium, that Rick Monday of the opposing LA Dodgers hit a home run off pitcher Steve Rogers, who was pitching in relief, thereby winning the game for the Dodgers and painfully robbing the Expos of their one and only chance of competing in that year's World Series against the American League pennant winners, the New York Yankees.
Did you really have to bring this up? Really?
There's a reason behind this.
And that reason is?
Well, because there's a book about it.
Did the book really have to be written? Did it really?
Well, you know, that expose of infamy that I just painfully mentioned to you, it will forever be known as Blue Monday, and is still regarded as probably the best remembered might have been in the team's 36-year history. And I'm telling you this, Peters, because journalist and author Danny Gallagher, who has penned four books on the Expos baseball legacy, adds to his Expos canon with a thorough look at that fateful day of infamy in October of 81, which is called, plainly enough, Blue Monday. Now, this thoroughly researched book, which also includes 73 interviews with many of the players and coaches from both teams who were part of this dramatic National League Championship Series, they tell the complete story about Blue Monday, the events that led up to it, and that fateful pitch and its wide-ranging aftermath. Now, besides offering detailed blow-by-blow descriptions of some of the crucial games and series during the Expos' drive to the World Series in 81, Gallagher gives a balanced look at what happened during that NLCS from both benches, with an emphasis on some of the unknown stories, like Tim Raines' father, who was promised by his employers an all-expense-paid trip to the World Series if the Expos beat the Dodgers, and some of the unsung heroes like Jerry White, whose home run off Jerry Royce won Game 3 for the Expos. Now, Gallagher also gives his due to the two players who faced off against each other that culminated in that fateful Game 5 home run, Steve Rogers and Rick Monday. Now, Gallagher certainly succeeds in that respect. Thanks to his quest for a scope and a sense of balance, we learned that Rick Monday was a player who was at the twilight of a 19-year career in the majors and was the very first pick of the very first Major League Baseball draft of amateur free agents in 1965. And as for Steve Rogers, we find out about a pitcher who was drafted in 60th place, was never a favorite of Dick Williams, he was called a fraud by the manager, and was building up an impressive career as one of the best pitchers in the majors during his career with the Expos. And unfortunately, he has found a sense of peace with himself following that Game 5.
Mm. Well, you mentioned Dick Williams, and I don't like to speak ill of the dead, but everything before a butt is a lie. He wasn't a nice human being.
No.
I remember actually he was in studio with me once because he had a book out. And I had asked him at the time, Wayne Twitchell was still pitching for the Expos. Mm-hmm. And if you recall, Wayne Twitchell's wife was complaining about life here in Montreal. There was not a lot of things she liked about living here. And she was basically homesick. It's understandable.
Yeah.
And one of the things she said is she didn't like the water here, the drinking water. Mm-hmm. And she said that the drinking water made her sick. And I asked Dick about this in studio, on air.
Yeah.
What is your response to Wayne Twitchell's wife saying that the water here was making her sick? To which he responded, on air. I don't know about the water making her sick, but her husband's pitching is making me sick. Thank you, Dick Williams.
Well, that's why he called his book No More Mr. Nice Guy.
He never was Mr. Nice Guy. Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
For all intents and purposes, Blue Monday, the book, further cements Danny Gallagher's reputation as an authority on the history of the Expos and has effectively kept the team's legacy alive through those books. Now, although Gallagher is one of the many who firmly believes that Major League Baseball will somehow return to Montreal one day, we can thank him and his books for keeping alive those fond memories of the Montreal Expos and how Nos Amours, Nos Amours, and I say it with a bit of affection, maybe some motion, we don't know, gave us so many good reasons to catch them in action at Jerry Park at the Olympic Stadium. No matter how many might have been in days of infamy, we were unsuspectingly served up.
Now, what's the title of this Debbie Downer's next book? Will that be Bill Buckner, Croquet Wickets for Legs? Would that be his next book?
Or, you know, Fred Merkel, the untold story of 1908, how the Giants threw the 1908 pennant.
Yes, yes. Anyway, the book is?
It's called Blue Monday by Danny Gallagher. It's published by Dundurn, and it's $23.99.
I'm sure it's a wonderful book.
It is.
I'm sure it'll sell well in Los Angeles. I'm not picking it up. That's all I'm saying. That's all. Nothing against the man, nothing against Danny, but no. Not going near it.
But it is a balanced book. He's not being a homer with this book.
He's not
leaning towards the Expos.
Yeah.
He tells a story from both sides, so you got to give him credit for that.
Okay. Again the title is
called Blue Monday. It's by Danny Gallagher, published by Dundurn. And it's $23.99.
And what other books do you recommend in said genre?
Well, just for Danny Gallagher's fans, he's written four other books. The book I liked the most was his book about the 1994 Expos, which was another might-have-been team that could have got another pennant or World Series championship, but a strike curtailed that one. And also, Jonah Carey has written, I think, probably the most definitive history of the Montreal Expos called Up, Up, and Away. Wonderful book. Wonderful book.
Okay. And how can people find you, sir? Certainly not sitting around Jerry Park. It's a little cold right now.
Yeah, or at the Olympic Stadium, just hoping and praying no chunks of concrete fall on my head.
Yeah.
But you can find me every week in the Montreal Times, digitally or in print, at www.mtltimes.ca.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Stuart.
And I will take you out to the ball game one day, Peter. You pick the stadium, okay?
Okay. Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but since we were just talking to Stuart about books, I've got one more book that I'd like you to read. I'd like you to purchase it first, but I'd like you to read. It's my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. It, of course, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages, you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and much, much more. Plus, as the title suggests, two men who actually left their footprints on the moon. So check it out. It was a lot of fun writing it. I hope you have as much fun reading it. It's available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. It's also available as an ebook for you Kindle folks out there. You can find it on my website, the link to either Amazon.ca or Amazon.com for the book. Plus, you can find it at BearManorMedia.com, which is the publisher of the book. So go ahead and buy it. I hope you'll enjoy it. I know you'll enjoy it. Anyway, it's that time, boys and girls, the time you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
A jail inmate who escaped from authorities and tried hitchhiking along a highway didn't enjoy freedom for long because the motorist he flagged down was a law enforcement officer. Greenup County jailer Mike Worthington says 31-year-old Alan Lewis was being transported to face charges in another county when he told the officer his handcuffs were too tight. The officer pulled over, and Worthington said after one handcuff was released, the two struggled and Lewis got free. The jailer says Lewis made it to a nearby highway and tried to flag down passing cars for a ride. He thought he was getting a ride, and he did, Worthington said. The person who stopped was a campus officer at Morehead State University who saw handcuffs hanging off one wrist. Worthington says Lewis was taken back to jail and now faces an escape charge. Now, why? Oh, why? Would you try to hitchhike on a highway when you clearly have handcuffs dangling off one wrist? I mean, who in their right mind is going to pick you up besides a cop? There's only one reason, and one reason only, why you would do that. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0491. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0491. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. The Stuff File reminds you never try to drown your sorrows. They'll just learn to swim anyway.